Hello and welcome. Welcome to the Dr. Lake Show. This is Dr. Paola Lake. I am really excited about being here today and especially the topic that we're going to be covering because this is so appropriate for Valentine's Day. For those of you that are thinking about what to do with your loved one and how to rekindle a few sparks, you know, maybe you've been together 20 years, maybe 10 years, maybe it's only a year, but I think it's always an important topic to figure out how do we keep that spark alive. And I'm here's a guest that I'm so happy to have. This is Cheryl Fraser, Dr. Cheryl Fraser, who is a Buddhist psychologist, a sex therapist, and also author of Buddha's Bedroom, someone who's done a lot of work with couples, a very sought after relationship expert, and also a colleague, someone that I have a lot of respect for, and who also does meditation and it works in a Buddhist community and offers community Buddhist services to people. So this is exciting to finally have you, Cheryl. Thank you so much.
Long overdue and a delightful way to settle in and spend a morning with you and your listeners.
Oh, so great. And I think, you know, I'd mentioned to you my partner had purchased your book and, you know, was interested in sort of this idea of how do we keep things rekindled? Because I think that's one of the issues that happens with people after the falling in love phase and is what happens to that spark that everyone's looking for. And you talk a lot in your book about that and the whole concept of falling in love. And before we even get into that, I'm just curious, which came first, the Buddhist part or the psychologist part for you?
I think what came first was discovering that true love didn't exist and that Sean Cassidy was not my soulmate. As a young girl, I had a desperate longing to be completed in love, the way men, women, gay, straight, trans, we long for this completion in love.
Yes.
And for those of you not in my age group, Sean Cassidy was the thing when I was 12. You know, he was a TV's Hardy Boy and he was a pop singer and he had flowing blonde locks. And I was deeply and erotically crazy in love with him, the way I think adolescent girls are profoundly good at. I had incredible sexual fantasies about this man. I wrote these long, longing fantasies about him. And I say it partly tongue in cheek, but partly not. That's really where it all began in terms of, can we find love that lasts a lifetime? Can we find passion and completeness and wholeness and being lit up that lasts forever? And spoiler alert, turns out Sean Cassidy was not my soulmate. Oh, he did not come and find me on Vancouver Island in a logging town and take me to Beverly Hills and keep me happy ever after.
Yeah.
That's where the longing to try to figure out this mystery began.
Right now you do talk about this in your book because, you know, the media and all the video programs, the movies we are drawn to. I remember The Notebook, you know, that's The Notebook is like, oh my God, that's like talk about, that's the ideal that we all dream of. But, you know, I don't know if is it doing a service to us? What are your thoughts about that?
I think it does a tremendous disservice because we don't understand that what we're seeing in The Notebook is profoundly rare. It is possible. I may tell the story of my grandparents at the end today that were The Notebook. It's very rare. The disservice is when we expect it to happen naturally and when we think there's something wrong with us, when after 6 months, a year, 18 months, the lust, the focused attention, the crazy falling in love phase starts to fade. And I know you're well aware of this, but for any listeners that aren't, I'll just give a brief overview of what's going on when we fall in love. We've got a major release of endorphins and other neurochemicals. We've got a major effect on our hormones. We've got our psychology, our attachment issues. issues, our hopes, our dreams, our longings, how our parents were, how our exes were. And it creates this dizzying biochemical cocktail. And I'm a huge fan of falling in love. Mm. If I could find a way to bottle it that wasn't damaging or illegal, I would want that feeling all the time. Yeah. But what's happening, you may be familiar with some research that indicates on functional MRI that the biochemistry and the way the brain lights up when we're falling in love, it actually mimics the biochemistry of obsessive compulsive disorder, which is why we're crazy in love. And you remember when you were falling in love with your person, you couldn't stop thinking about him or her. You'd be in a big business meeting and you'd have a flashback to, you know, the kiss last night, and you'd become aroused, you'd become turned on. And it isn't your fault that you're crazy in love, because you're crazy in love. Here's where it becomes problematic, is we mistake that as meaning this is my person and I will feel that way forever. Yeah. There's the cognitive error. Yeah. There's the pain point. So when that starts to fade, a roller coaster pulls into the station and slows down at some point. We often misinterpret, and culture, popular media, love stories, romance is still the highest grossing book publication genre is romance. When it's like, oh, hey, you left your socks on the floor, we think, well, I've picked the wrong person. I often say that the three most important words I ever get to say as a psychologist and couples expert and sex therapist are, you are normal. You are normal if spontaneous lust has faded away. You are normal if you feel bored with your partner and your relationship. By normal here, I mean typical. Mm-hmm. And then I try to teach, but don't settle for normal and typical. What can we do, which is our main tenet of our conversation today, to reignite what maybe used to come easily when we were on the roller coaster? Yeah. What can we do to reinvest? And as I often say, make love and passion intentional. Mm-hmm. Don't wait around to be swept up by lust and love the way it easily came when we were falling in love and dating. And don't mistake the reality of the change in our biochemistry, the change in our psychology and longer term love. Don't mistake that as meaning you're with the wrong person.
And that is something people do. I mean, I know people that are in love with falling in love. And so if there's a problem, the minute that there's that spark is gone, they start to wander and think that the problem is that this person's the wrong one. So I got to find that spark somewhere else until they do the same pattern. Right. So in the end, they will relive the same issue. So the question then is, so there's a recognition of that. And how I think is what people would struggle with. And what are your thoughts about what we do to start to recreate, or can we recreate? What can we do?
Short answer is yes, we can, but it's not that common because it takes work and effort. And we have been schooled in our experience, our hopes and dreams that if it doesn't come naturally, there's something wrong with us. So we would repeat that message and say, can I ask people to hold that gently and say, I may be thinking, there's something wrong with us. You're the wrong person. The thrill always dies. We're normal. Well, you're typical. But I really want to charge people with something very simple that we don't really think about enough, which is think of everything else in your life, your career, your hobbies, your parenting, your fitness, perhaps your food choices. We spend a lot of time and energy and effort to become good or excellent at other things that matter to us. And we have this like sort of mass cultural delusion, I think, that it love should take care of itself. Yeah. Lust should take care of itself. Our relationship, we kind of do the dating, have the sex, nail it down, make a choice to commit, and then we neglect it benignly. Yeah. Not because we don't care, but because we haven't heard enough, in my view, the very clear teaching that if you neglect your garden, it's going to overgrow with weeds and potentially not yield what you wish. It's not that hard to weed your relationship garden. Yeah. It takes some time and some intention. And I often teach, make your love life a hobby, in that a hobby is something we choose to do because we want to. We block off time for it, or it's not a hobby. And we usually learn to be better at it. We consult a golf pro. We read something about how to make souffles even more elegantly. And with our love life, so few people study and learn and immerse. Everybody listening is an exception to that, which really excites me. Because they are wanting to spend their most valuable commodity, which is their attention and time.
Yeah.
Listening to you and I discuss this deep topic of what can we do to reignite our love. So the short answer is you can do it. I'm a realist, so most of you won't, mm-hmm. but those of you that will, let's keep talking.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's keep talking.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm going to teach very briefly a model that couples really cotton on to, because I think it really reflects our direct experience of, I call it the three keys to passion, or the passion triangle. And I ask each of us to rate ourselves. You can do it right now as you hear these. How are you doing, you know, strong, medium, or weak on each of these three aspects of what I would say defines a passionate, whole, rewarding romantic relationship with your chosen person? The first one I call intimacy. And here I'm not using intimacy as a euphemism for sex.
Right.
I'm meaning more emotional, psychological intimacy. And this encompasses things like being able to communicate well and deeply, learning how to resolve conflict in a way that is somewhat useful, having each other's back, that sense of deep, you know, trust and encouragement over time, future hopes and dreams, what John Gottman in that style of working would call marital friendship, really the backbone for most of us of a long-term relationship. You know, if you get great news, who's the first person you want to call? Yeah. When something goes wrong, who's the first person you want to call? A lot of couples listening will rate themselves pretty high on this one right now. Mm-hmm. Or if they're arguing a lot, they're bickering a lot, they're in conflict, they might rate themselves medium or low. But it's generally the one in long-term relationship that, and I've got a quiz people can take. It's a free quiz.
Oh, beautiful.
We can link to it.
Yeah.
And they can rate themselves. It takes about 10 minutes. And you can rate yourself and get your score on these three keys to passion, and then a video teaching from me about what to do about it. The second key I call thrill, and this one's the nebulous one. This is the one that is difficult for us to recreate. We'll circle back to it later in this conversation, probably. But by thrill, I mean the butterflies in the stomach, the lust in the loins, the excitement, that OCD obsessive, fantastic feeling, the falling in love, the interest. My first date with my beloved, we met for breakfast because I was trying to blow him off. And I figured if I met him at 7 a.m., I could get out of there at 7:45. It ended up being a 4-hour conversation that morphed way onto the seawall and walking and talking. That's the kind of thrill I'm talking about. Just, I am so freaking interested in you. You are fascinating to me. Let me learn you. That's the second quality. Most of us who've been together more than a year, year and a half or two, that's a somewhat arbitrary number, but a decent one to work with. We don't have a lot of thrill, or it's sporadic. Maybe we've been away for a month and I'm so excited to see you. And the third chunk, the one people neglect at their peril, is the sensuality side of these three keys to passion. And there I mean all things erotic, from holding hands when you walk, or having your hand on the back of his or her neck when they're driving and you're in the passenger seat, to the entire spectrum of erotic activity, sexual activity, right to exploring taboos if that's something you want to explore, exploring your wild side, a crazy hot lovemaking, sweet lovemaking, tantric orgasms that last for minutes instead of seconds, all of the sensual side. And I just said people neglect that at their peril, because I was teaching some classes a few months ago live online. I'll be teaching them again in March if people are interested. We can link to them below, a free hour and a half class on these three keys to passion. And in it, I decided to do a quick poll. And I created just a little five answers. I said, how would you rate your sex life these days? The first answer was, it's great. The second was, it's good, but we could do better in quality or quantity. The next was, it's pretty poor. We're really struggling in that area. The next was, we rarely ever have sex. And the fifth was, no sex at all. I was even surprised, and I'm an expert in this field. I'm aware of the dire straits of long-term love, sexuality. Only 8% of the 500 or so people that I polled, 8% said they had a great sex life.
Wow. 8%. And do you look at how long they've been together? Like, is there, you know...
It was a quick poll, so I didn't collect that kind of data, but the majority of people who tend to gravitate to my work have been together for a while. They're not in their first year or two, kind of the flesh of dating, because my entire model is, how do we recapture, reignite? If we're already pretty good, how do we keep that going in the long term? But, you know, it's just a straw poll. We're both psychologists. We're both statisticians. Yeah. We know it doesn't, you know,
of course,
all of reality.
But it gives you an idea of what's out there.
Tremendously sobering number. And it was also reassuring. If you remember, I've taught everybody a few minutes ago, what are the three most important words I ever say? You are normal.
Okay.
So for the 92% of people on those calls to hear they aren't the only ones who have an okay, mediocre, poor, lousy, or non-existent sex life. Already there's hope.
I think it's good for people to know that. It's good, because I think when, you know, if we continue to have this illusion that that is exactly how it should be, that you see yourself as a minority, then that is when you start to make decisions outside of, you know, that would strengthen the marriage. Right. Yeah.
Right. The assumption is everybody else is having good sex, but us,
yes.
And there's therefore something wrong with us, either sexually or in our relationship.
Yeah.
And as we're aware, accurate stats are hard to gather on the actual frequency of sexual affairs in a committed long-term relationship, marital or otherwise, but they're high.
Yeah.
Probably between 24-46% of long-term committed couples have a sexual affair at least once in their history. I'm a realist. I'm a scientist like you. I want to look at what's actually happening, not what I wish was happening, and then address it.
Yeah.
So the biggest cause of affair is someone finds us fascinating. We recreate thrill and sensuality with someone new because novelty is the best aphrodisiac.
Yes.
Chemically, mentally, you're new, you're exciting, you're uncharted territory. And I sort of give a bit of a cautionary tale that we can all relate to, which is if you're bored with your mate, if you're bored with your relationship, even if you love them and you're great parents together and you're not looking to break up, don't forget that anyone new will find your man or woman, gay, straight, trans, whatever your committed relationship is, will find that person fascinating. Someone new will find your boring old spouse super fascinating.
Yeah.
So if there's a business meeting today and there's an attractive other there who meets your spouse, ring on their finger or not, and says, he, she is so interesting. They love skiing the way I do. Oh my goodness. They're also obsessed with, you know, the TV program Schitt's Creek. I love this person. And suddenly we get an interest.
Yeah.
Like you, I can guess without even asking you, you've probably had so many people on your therapeutic couch over the years, as I have. Male, female, gay, and straight, sobbing and saying, Cheryl, I am the last person ever who ever would cheat. And I found myself having sex with someone else. I don't know how it happened.
Yeah.
I abhor infidelity. I've judged rather viciously other people who've strayed. I don't know what happened.
Yeah.
And fundamentally, I say, well, we know what happened. At some point, you chose to kiss or unzip. And I'm not being facetious. We know how it happened. The question is why.
Yeah.
The question is what? What was the unmet need? What did you get deluded by? What led you to act against your deeper choices? And how can we help you forgive yourself, understand what happened? And as you're likely aware, our listeners maybe are not, some decent research indicates that more than half of committed marriages or other common law committed relationships, more than half that suffer through an affair, the couples do stay together. So our old, kind of Aunt Fanny statement belief that, well, people always break up after an affair is simply not true.
No.
That points to the complexity and the layers and the depth of what finding thrill and sensuality elsewhere can do to your relationship, but that, hey, no matter what, a lot of couples who join my online immersion program, I'd say about 10-15% of them are post-affair. They're looking, how can we reinvest? How can we recover? How can we move through the pain of betrayal? How can we, one of my catchphrases is, how can we fall in love over and over again with the one we're already with?
Yeah.
How can we create a notebook? Yeah. And people are going, well, for goodness sakes, you two smart psychologists, tell us how. Well, it's not easy.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's a, first of all, a real choice to say, I'm going to make my love life a hobby. I'm going to invest time, energy, and learning in you and I. And if anyone wants to roll their eyes, roll them. I don't care. It doesn't make me wrong. You need to plan.
It doesn't change the fact. Yeah.
You need to schedule sex. You need to learn about the difference between spontaneous and responsive desire, which I'll cover briefly in a moment.
Yeah.
You need to understand that a lack of spontaneous desire is normal. And if you don't create the circumstances for sex, you'll go weeks or months without it, and so on. So pause. Let's cover some fundamental important sex therapy teaching. For people who want to read more about this, I'd recommend Emily Nagoski's excellent book, Come As You Are. A terrific book. She's a sex educator. She pulls together a lot of super important research on how our bodies and sexuality work. It's a newer book, a couple years old now. And she's a beautiful, elegant, funny, crisp writer. It's a brilliant book. And you can learn a lot more about what I'm going to teach right now briefly in that book for those of you interested. There's a different way of approaching it that's similar in my own book, Buddha's Bedroom, as well. But spontaneous desire goes along with the roller coaster ride, the lust, the falling in love. And it's the, I want to rip your clothes off right now feeling, you know, when I would kiss my beloved, we've only been together 7 years. So I was, you know, 49, 50 when we met, I wasn't a spring chicken. When our tongues would touch, I would just be completely turned on, horny and ready to go. That's spontaneous lust. Yes. It can happen through touch. It could happen through a thought. It could happen with our groin feeling hot, lubricated, hard, turned on, almost out of the blue, spontaneous desire, spontaneous lust. Love that feeling. Sign me up. Greatest ever, next to spontaneous lust plus chocolate. That might be even better, but it's great. Who doesn't love right. spontaneous lust? What the research and our own bodies and our own relationship experience teach us is that the majority of long-term couples have very little or no spontaneous desire. I like to say, you know, it's kind of like your adolescent spontaneously offering to clean out the garage for you tomorrow. It yeah. might happen. If it does, enjoy the hell out of it, but don't count on it. That's spontaneous.
And I have had some couples talk about how important it is for them to have that spontaneity. And, you know, they don't want to be scheduling. It feels contrived.
Exactly. You biggest know? Complaint. And that's yeah. why I prefaced it by saying, I know some of you are going to roll your eyes, but...
Yeah.
And what I like to say is, if you schedule sex, you'll have sex. Oh, scheduling sex isn't romantic. You know what's not romantic? Never having sex. So we got to approach it from both directions. The work I do is more of a totality that begins with structuring and building up desire in a more predicated, chosen way. Right. And then through all of that, you may, to your delight, find that a little more spontaneous desire is happening as an outcome of planned desire. So we'll put a pin in that for a moment, but that's okay. to give people hope. The second type of desire, sexual desire, is called responsive desire. It's called different things by different teachers, similar concepts, wonderfully important stuff to study. And responsive desire, as the name implies, is desire arises in response to something. Let me give a very concrete example. You're laying in bed. It's Saturday morning. You don't have to get up. There's nothing urgent. And one of you says, hey, you know, maybe we should get it on. And you're like, yeah, so don't feel like it. But what do you say, baby? Why don't you try to turn me on? And to be explicit, I'm going to be explicit because mm-hmm. it's important in my
yes,
field.
Absolutely.
You might say to your sweetheart, well, if you go down on me, if you give me oral sex, I think I'll wake up. I think the body will move in to turn on. Absolutely. Happy to do that. You're flat. You're at 0 out of 10 on any sexual feelings whatsoever. Your partner starts to touch, kiss, caress, whatever turns you on, dive right between your legs if that works for you. And what do you know? In a few minutes, most of the time, not always, the body will respond. That's responsive desire. That can be in response to sweet nothings. That can be in response to touch or overt stimulation using a sex toy. It can also be in response to, we've set Tuesday as sex night and it's Tuesday, so we're going to get it on because it's Tuesday. I'm at a 0 out of 10, no turn on whatsoever. You're at a 0 of 10, no turn on whatsoever. But we go have a shower, we play, we wash each other off, we tickle, we tease a bit, and we're not into it. And then we get into it, the bodies take over, and that was really nice. Now, I want more. I want passion. So do I. Absolutely. But right. I deal with real couples with real bodies and real problems yes, and real yes, life. And the yes. fact is, everything shows that if you make your sex life more intentional, schedule sex, start expanding your repertoire. I take couples in my program through some exercises on really identifying some of their fantasies and taboos. Your taboo might be as simple as making love with the lights on for the first time. It might be quite dark and crazy and erotic and dressing up and tying each other up. Whatever it is, what are we not admitting to that we might like to play with or at least share the idea with for a turn on? It takes intentionality to help that happen. I want to just put out another reassuring factoid for people. Some of our wonderful British Columbia-based based sex therapists. Some of the best sex therapy research is coming out of University of British Columbia. Rosemary Bisson is a very important researcher in female and male sexuality, primarily female desire. And she has a statement I really like to quote and clarify for people. She says, the majority of long-term couples start making love from a place of sexual neutrality. Now, what does that mean? It means what you and I are talking about. It means they start making love and neither of them's turned on. That's not spontaneous desire. Now, of course, a lot of couples listening may have a related issue, which is one of us is turned on pretty easy and has spontaneous desire. The other doesn't. Are we broken? No, you are normal. What will we do about it? Move towards scheduling sex. It's not the be all and end all. It's just one technique people can start with right away. I teach more of a totality, but it's a very important piece to make your sex life happen. And to reassure people and maybe give them a bit of a smile. I like to say, look, I go see a personal trainer 3 times a week. I never wake up and go, yay, I want to go to the gym, ever. Hasn't happened once. I drag my butt in because I know it will be good for me. Yeah. I know I will enjoy it and I know I'll feel great afterwards and I'll be really glad I did. Treat your sex life that way for a while, romantic or not. I don't feel like it. I'm not really into it, but I know I'll enjoy it and I'll be glad I did. And that may not sound romantic, but it's actually profoundly romantic. If we redefine romance to say dealing with the truth of our lives, COVID and pandemic lockdown, 2 kids we're trying to school at home, caring for an aging parent as a sandwich generation, worrying about work, a financial downturn due to the pandemic. That's real frickin' life. And what I think is beautifully romantic is saying in the middle of this crazy, amazing, difficult, challenging life, I'm going to make you a priority. I'm going to make us a priority. And I'm not going to sit and wait around for our teenager to offer to clean out the garage spontaneously. Yeah. I'm not willing to put our sex life and our love life and our intimate connection in the hands of feeling like it.
Yeah.
Because that's a really terrible way to build a business. That's a really terrible way to be a great parent. That's a really terrible way to create a beautiful vegetable garden, is I'll wait around till I spontaneously feel like it.
You mentioned the topic of newness and how we're drawn to newness. I've always thought, you know, we take for granted sometimes that we think we know everything about our partner.
Yes.
And so, you know, how can we bring newness, you know, and start to expand our awareness of our partner instead of those habitual sort of thoughts we have that we just know them all. We know who they are. We know everything about them.
Love that question. Let's call it lazy mind. And I often say, and it's a little challenging, but I'm not afraid to challenge people if it helps them grow and be happier and healthier. I say, if you're bored with your partner's not the problem. Your mind is the problem. Your mind is bored. There's a ridiculous movie from years ago. I think Drew Barrymore, Adam Sandler, and it's 50.
I love that one. Yes.
Yeah, it's a delightful movie. Everybody should watch it. The premise, which is completely neurologically not accurate, but we'll leave that. The premise is she has a head injury that means she wakes every morning completely forgetting everything about her life. So every day she meets him new. Every day he teaches her who he is. Every day she learns to go from go away, creepy guy I've never met before, to this is a fascinating human being. So can we perform thought experiments? The answer is yes, we can. On choosing to meet our partner new, metaphorically or literally. And you can literally arrange a date in your house or out of your house, depending on your travel restrictions right now. And you can play a game. It's actually kind of a turn on. And show up and pretend you're strangers and ask each other, what do you do? What do you love? What's important to you in a relationship? If that's a little out of your comfort zone, good. I like people to step out of their comfort zone while staying in their safety zone, because that's the zone we grow in. Mm-hmm. But that's a little woo for you. There's an exercise in my book, or I'm sure you can Google just online or make them up yourself, most certainly, on asking your partner interesting questions. So you can pick a date night, have a cup of tea or a beer or over a meal, walking the dogs, and say, okay, babe, if we won some crazy contest that gave us 2 weeks a year in 3 different beautiful places in the world, where would you want to go? You may know one or two of those guesses correctly, but you probably don't know the third. And then you can get more silly. You can say, you know, if you were reborn as an animal, what would you want to be and why? you probably don't know that about your sweetheart. I'm pretty sure my guy, it would be a leopard because he's obsessed with big cats, but I'd have to ask him. And then you can ask, of course, relationship and sexual questions as well. You can say, you know, where do you see our relationship 1 year from now? And if one thing could change, what would you love it to be? I'm aware that can open up a can of worms. I'm aware that might lead to arguing or pain points. We shouldn't necessarily ignore the places we need to look under the bed and see how many dust bunnies are there. You could ask sexual questions. You know, what is one of your favorite sexual things we've ever done together? Just pretend you don't know everything because you don't. I think it is true.
Yeah.
Partner is vast. They contain multitudes. I think that's Walt Whitman or another poet. But oh my goodness, how lazy or arrogant of our mind to assume, even if I've slept next to you for 52 years, to assume I know everything there is about you.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't.
Yeah. And so it's a way of bringing some stimulation because in that newness, we see that partner. And, you know, I remember interviewing a psychologist who was a brain psychologist. He was talking about what really we thrive off is that novelty and stimulating those new neural pathways. And that is what brings a little bit more spice and thriving energy into our lives, right?
Right. Yeah. And it's a big challenge. I mean, we're literally talking about manufacturing spontaneity or creating novelty in a situation which doesn't feel new. So now let's talk briefly about the Buddhist side of mind training and being in the present moment, a phrase that's become so ubiquitous, people don't understand what it means anymore. And I got a little thought experiment I love to do here. It's very simple. I want everybody listening, and I want you and I to do it, to imagine that I've just given you a sliver of the most exquisite, creamy chocolate truffle on the planet. Just a sliver. And I want people, unless they're driving, I want them to close their eyes. And I want them to imagine placing that sliver of chocolate, silky truffle on your tongue. And it's melting. Your taste buds are alive. And so, now most of us, myself included, I'm salivating. How are you doing over there?
Yeah, pretty good.
Now, here's the thing. If we were all in a room, which I hope we all are one day, and we did this little experiment together, and I then said, how was that chocolate? People would say, it was delicious. It was lovely. Oh my goodness. It was just robust. And I say, great. Was it a special chocolate? No. Have you had chocolate before? In my case, thousands of them over the lifetime. Yet with that moment, that chocolate was new. That experience of chocolateness was new, even if we've had it 1,000 times before. We're absolutely capable of adoring the same thing over and over. It might be your perfect Guatemalan blend of coffee bean. In my case, an exquisite first flush Darjeeling tea. I don't go, meh, had it before. But that's unfortunately the mind state we bring to our marriage, our partner, our sex life, and this kiss. Mm-hmm. I want to kiss you. We rarely say, unless of course you're one of those strange and beleaguered people who don't like chocolate, my heart goes out to you. I'm sure you have your thing. You rarely say, I don't want chocolate. It's so interesting. It's such a simple example we can all relate to. What are we doing with our mind that the bite of a favorite meal, the sip of a coffee we love every day is new and lovely today?
Yes. Yeah.
And yet with kissing, with touching, with answering, hearing how your day was, we check out, we say, I've been there before. We've been there before. The take-home message is the novelty and excitement and interest of the moment is contained entirely in the mind, not in the chocolate. Me being interested in you is entirely contained in my mind, not in you. It's a challenging teaching because it puts the responsibility on each of us to create the very thing we feel is missing.
I know you have some meditations or in your book that are geared to facilitate that experience of connecting to that sensory experience of your partner in a different way. Can you share any of them?
I can briefly share them. You bet. Think of the little chocolate experiment, but doing it with sensual touch on your partner's body. So I suggest you block off 15 minutes to an hour. You flip a coin in terms of who's the receiver and the giver. Let's say you're the receiver, your partner's the giver this first time. And then later in the week, reverse the experiment. I don't like both of you to give and receive in the same session because I want you to learn full reception and full giving. Wrap that up, and then in another session, switch it. So you're lying down, and there's two ways to do it. There's more than two, but two simplified ways. One is to do a non-erogenous zone sensual touch experiment. So I don't touch your genitals, your bum, your boobs, anywhere that's a more traditional sexual right. center. And then your partner can explore using their fingers, using their hair, using even a feather or a piece of silk, just exploring touch, kissing, nibbling, whatever they like. In the present moment, what does it feel like for my fingertips to touch and stroke the inside of your arm? So if I'm the giver, I'm the toucher, I'm focusing the way we just did on that imaginary sliver of chocolate. I'm focusing my attention as best I'm able. The mind will wander, et cetera. You bring it back to the feeling of skin under my fingertip. Even more powerful for the receiver, because we as the receiver get to, as best we can, have in meditation what we'd call a direct experience of the actual sensation of touch as your finger strokes my shoulder blade or your lips graze along my neck. And what we will find is some of it's pleasant, some of it feels unpleasant, and some of it feels neutral. But the key is it's not entirely dissimilar to Masters and Johnson's, the sex therapist from the 50s. They had a sensate touch exercise used for sex therapy to help people learn what they actually liked and didn't like. This is a sort of more modernized version of mindful sensual touch to discover what's it like to be touched in this present moment. A second format of doing it is also allowing the more traditional arousal zones, genitals, bums, and boobs and whatnot, and then using this touch for the receiver to really focus on what does this touch actually feel like when it's different from our usual touch routine. It's different from the usual ways I like my penis, my clitoris, my breasts, my whatever touched to turn me on, to move me towards orgasm. So it's really opening up your entire body palette, and rarely are we doing this in a long-term relationship, to new types of touch. I often say one line that people resonate to quite strongly is I say, you know, the typical North American sex life is nipple, nipple, crotch, goodnight. We've got our routine. Yeah. You touch me here, I suck you there, and then we both hopefully orgasm and we go to bed. And it's lovely.
It's very targeted.
Very targeted routine.
Yeah.
It's got a goal in mind, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. are all the antithesis of exploration, yeah. novelty, and experiencing what's actually happening.
Yeah. Yeah. And for people, I mean, what would be nice is for people to access your book and perhaps your course so you can give at the end. How much time, and I know with busy lives, everyone's caught up in their busy lives of work and children, and maybe COVID has increased it for some people. I think that's an issue people run into. They get tired, exhausted at the end of the day, want to go to bed. I know there's no magic formula for this.
No magic formula. But you've already touched on one of the best bits of advice is end of the day. End of the day is the worst time to anti-prioritize your erotic life. Less so when I was 20, I could, you know, be awake all the time, but you know, life is busy and it's mentally stressful, or at least mentally demanding. I don't love to put the stress word out into our subconsciouses. Mentally demanding. We've got lots of things to do between work and family and life and finances and dogs and cats and birds and everything else. But I don't have research on this, but I would put forward that for the majority of folks, it seems if we have sex, it's at the end of the day, right. when we're at our worst. And we're tired. And frankly, we would rather watch Netflix because we're tired and we're not turned on. We have no spontaneous desire. We're not horny. It feels like a choy. It feels like, oh, one more thing. One thing I really ask people to do, at least one in four sensual encounters. And I don't want to limit sex to intercourse and orgasm, by the way. It can be a sensual encounter that's cuddling naked and smooching and snuggling and then falling asleep. That's an erotic encounter. Mm-hmm. I talk about the whole spectrum of sensuality and keeping that alive, not just sex with orgasm or that type of direct pleasure, all of it. But anyway, I challenge people at least one out of four sensual encounters, ideally more, have them earlier in the day. For example, we're recording this very close to Valentine's weekend. Mm-hmm. And if people are interested, I recorded a couple of videos they can access on my website or elsewhere. One is how to design the perfect Valentine's date. Perfect. And in it, I just released it a couple of days ago. And in it, I say, if you're going out for dinner, or for a lot of us staying in for dinner, hopefully making it a little special, some candlelight, some special food, maybe a bit of bubbly, et cetera, make love before dinner. Make love before you go to the restaurant at 6 p.m. Revolutionary idea. Aren't I clever? It's so obvious, but we don't think of it.
Yeah.
Make love before you go. Then you've got the afterglow. You've got kind of your walls are even more down. We always feel, almost always, we feel more smooshy and connected and kind of sparkly and sweet, a little drowsy after we make love. We've got our specialness as we're sitting at the table. We're like, we were naked an hour ago. That was fun. And then, especially if you have a glass or two of wine and you're drowsy and you get home at 10 and you've got to walk the dog before bed, it's like it gets put shut off to the side. It's like people who answer non-essential stupid emails for the first 2 hours that they're at work, and they shuttle off their really important creative project to when they're the most tired at 2 in the afternoon, when most body clocks aren't very great at 2 in the afternoon. Prioritize. Make love earlier. Have a morning quickie now and then. Have a shower together and caress each other a little for 3 minutes before you split off into your workday. Don't leave one of the most beautiful aspects of being alive, one of the most beautiful aspects of being in the wonder and beauty and frustration and difficulty of a longer-term relationship. Don't marginalize it to, I'll give you my most tired, most grumpy, most disinterested self for such a beautiful thing, something we used to arrange heaven and earth to have time for when we were falling in love.
And I like the fact that, you know, that is not always connected to sex, and sometimes it may be sex, but there is a connection that's happening when you're just being intimate and cuddling and touching that can have us feel close to somebody. So it may be, but at the end of the day, I think also people start, if they push themselves at that state when they're already tired, we want to build positive associations with that experience. Mm-hmm. And if it becomes completely like an obligatory job, you want to keep some of that energy to be fully present and have a positive experience of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And that is tricky, because that's a very accurate statement, but unfortunately it can be used as, well, therefore I'm not going to when I'm tired. So we need to kind of ease back and forth. On Sundays, we say, really, I'm tired. I'm going to enjoy it more if we wait till Sunday when I've got time. And other times, really tired, let's give it a shot.
Yeah.
And also, you know, there are toys, there are lubrications, a vibrating device, ways to help turn the body on when you're tired that can be helpful. There's no one right prescription for anyone.
Yeah.
But I would put forward, there's a wrong prescription, which is expect your sex life to take care of itself.
Yes. That's a passive stance. So, you know, to be, so really we should be putting the same energy into that as we would with fitness, to have a certain commitment of time, not just be passive about it and expect it to flourish in that way. The other thing, because I don't know if you know Kim Switnicki, she was a coach. She's published a little bit on sexuality, but there, one of the things she would talk about is that there's in the act of reserving that time and connecting, even if it's just a physical touch, it actually wakes up those senses with your partner, and it helps you relate to them more by the act of doing it. So if you don't do anything, we're more inclined to kind of forget about it. So it brings it to the forefront of our minds when we're actually engaged in that with our partner.
Yeah, and the forefront of our bodies. A lot of people report when they, you know, decide they're going to make love once a week and they schedule it, that they end up a little more horny and a little more sexually in tune in sort of a use it and you don't lose it kind of model.
Yeah, absolutely.
And some research to start supporting that. And particularly as we age, for those of us that are postmenopausal, men as their bodies age, and we can have performance issues, erection difficulties. Women, I certainly speak to a lot of women in my peer group who are in our mid-50s that are postmenopausal, who used to have very easy and luscious and strong orgasms, and now the body's having very weak orgasms, like a 1 or 2 out of 10 in intensity, when an 8 or 9 out of 10 was always normal till menopause. And so we also need to work with changes. And and losses and reorienting our approach to our sexuality and what our expectations are for our sexuality. And not just, of course, in aging and menopause, but through pregnancy, through childbirth, through having an infant at home, through all these life phases in our mental and physiological approach to our bodies and sexuality, that it's important for people, again, to hear that they are normal, that these, that I had a couple in my course last year who hadn't made love since the birth of their baby, and their baby was 13 months old. And they were a young, robust, super fit, in love couple, late 30s. She was a professional ballet teacher of a studio, and he was a professional soccer coach, used their bodies in their bodies, and just created an elephant in the room around sex. They'd awkwardly tried once to have vaginal sex 3-4 months after the birth. It had been painful. They backed right away.
Wow.
I have so many stories of couples who haven't made love in a year, 3 years, 6 years, 7 years, and not just people in their 50s, 60s, 70s and beyond, people in their 20s, 30s and 40s, that it becomes a thing. It becomes the thing we're dreading, the thing we can't talk about, the thing we're afraid to approach. So I want to acknowledge that here as well, in the "you are normal" part of reassuring people that sex doesn't take care of itself for the majority of couples. And for those of you that it is taking care of itself, then I charge you with the responsibility of saying, figure out what's working so you can keep doing that and keep your passion and your love alive long term.
And this is why there's value in having these conversations and helping people hear that this is okay for them to be where they're at. But there's hope in this, in that your message is very hopeful, because it gives people a sense that it not only is it okay, but, you know, we can improve it.
Yes. And I sometimes use an analogy, a very simple one to all of us, which is fitness or weight loss. Let's say we've got 50 pounds to lose. We've kind of neglected that aspect of our being. It's important to us. We've been busy, tired, stressed, and all the reasons. And then we decide we're making this a priority. There's almost no doubt that an intelligent, well-supported person can lose 50 pounds over, say, a year or 2 years. If they have the right information, the right coaching, the right support, they learn what to do, and they do it fairly consistently and fairly well. I like to remind people that's a similar mental approach I'd like them to take to renovating a relationship, especially when we're in really dire straits. We haven't had sex in years. We argue all the time. There's a lot of bitterness. There's hurt. There may be past wounds, betrayals to get through. I work with real people with real lives. Of course, it's not all, you know, ponies and sunshine and rainbows. But you too, I am quite sure in your clinical work, have seen incredible stories of resilience and recovery in couples that privately, we as clinicians may have thought, I don't think they're going to be able to put Humpty back together again, but I'm here to help them, including if they decide to separate. And I've also worked with couples who have, you know, 9 out of 10 of everything's working great and they split. It's, do we bring the willingness to say, I'm investing in us. I'm willing to see, I'm going to use kind of hyperbole language because I think it's important. Am I willing to invest in making us great? I want to be an exceptional couple. That's not super common. We may know one in our circle, maybe, that what we see is exceptional. They adore each other. They light up. I have a story to finish off about that. And we want that. Well, it's possible, but so is 50 pounds weight loss or getting buff arms. It takes energy, commitment, repetition, and struggle. And a lot of times you don't want to do it, but if you want the outcome enough, we commit and we do what it takes. And that's what I try to encourage and support and cry with and hope with couples to do.
I think that's a great
relationship.
Absolutely great message. You know, we put the time into it and that we'll get something back from doing that. I want to hear your story.
I want to tell you this story. This is a story of the couple who inspired me that maybe love could last a lifetime and maybe the thrill doesn't have to die. Although that is more typical, it doesn't have to be that way. And this is the story of a couple called Norman and Evie, who were also my grandparents. So Norman was born in Wales, and his father was a physician in a small, very poor Welsh coal mining town. Norman was not academically inclined, and so his future was to go down the mines and be a coal miner. And those young men died very young of black lung and terrible illnesses or mine collapses. We're talking, you know, 100 years ago. So instead, my granddad lied about his age at 17 and, you know, got his way onto a freighter bound for the great country of Canada. And he ended up in the prairies in the dead of winter, and he got a job for a German farmer at whatever the wage was back then, a dollar a week and room and board, maybe something like that. And then granddad tells this story. He tells the story of in the spring, it was time for the spring community dance, and everybody came from, you know, everywhere around in horse carts and whatnot. And he talks about standing against the wall. And as I visualize him and the other young bucks kind of standing against the wall, chewing a hayseed or something, and they watch the pretty girls come in and file in their dresses they've been working on all winter, you know, patchwork dresses and gingham dresses and whatnot. Pretty girl, pretty girl, pretty girl. Then he sees her. And he says, "Who is that?" And the other lads say, "Oh, that's Evelyn, but don't even think about it." And my granddad says, "Why not?" And they say, "Because she's engaged to be married." And my granddad famously said, "Not for long." So he wooed her, stole her away from her fiance. They wed, they moved out to British Columbia, where I and you were from here on the West Coast, and started their life. And I'm sure it wasn't all easy. They were poverty stricken. They went through the Second World War, and they actually moved to Vancouver, and she was working Rosie the Riveter style in the shipyards in Burnaby and beyond. They lost their first child at the age of 2 to pneumonia. My uncle, we never got to meet. And then they had my dad, who was sickly and managed to obviously make it. So fast forward, I grew up here on Vancouver Island with my grandparents in the same town. I spent a lot of time with them. And when I was with Norm and his Evie, my granddad and granny, every time she walked in the room, my granddad lit up like a Christmas tree. His face softened, his blue eyes sparkled. He said, "Oh, Effie, how can I help you? Let me get that for you." He was such a gentleman. He adored her. He elevated her. And after retirement, they used to, in their SUV with their Siamese cat or their RV, they'd go around and they'd go to square dances and they danced into their 80s and he'd, you know, shepherd her around. And so fast forwarding, I saw this incredible love affair. Dad says it was pretty rocky when he was a kid. And he also said it was pretty sexy when he was a kid. They lived in one room with only a curtain between their bedroom and where he slept. And he said, yep, they had a lot of passion. In their 80s, my grandmother was diagnosed and died very rapidly from lung cancer, which of course was a terrible loss for us all. They'd been married more than 60 years. Wow. And what we quickly learned after that was that granddad had Alzheimer's. But that their bond was such a fluid dance that she had filled in all the gaps. And my granddad, when he was younger, he used to tell me how much he loved his Evie and how she had this wavy blonde hair. And he always said, "And she's got eyes the blue of the ocean on a spring day." So after he lost his Evie, my granddad went downhill very fast. A lot of grief, a lot of confusion, and fairly advanced Alzheimer's that none of us had seen, even though we probably saw them 3 times a week. So he went into decline, and he had a very strong body. He lived a long time, and I was able to visit him a lot. I was back living locally for a while. And one day I went in to see him, and I was in my early 30s, I think. And he looked up and he saw me, and you may guess what happened next, because I had wavy blonde hair.
Oh.
And I have blue eyes.
And arguably, so he thought you were her.
The color of the ocean on a spring day. And he looked up and he said, "Evie, you're here." And then he lit up like a Christmas tree. Oh, absolute adoration.
It's a great story.
Absolute love.
Yeah.
And I don't know what sense came to me that day. It was not me. It was something wiser than me. But I said the right thing. I didn't say, "No, Granddad, it's me, Cheryl. Evie's gone." I said, "Yes, Norm, I'm here." And he closed his eyes. And he looked so happy and so peaceful. And he had, I think, the most peaceful nap he'd had in years. Huh. So that story taught me, reminded me that the thrill does last forever.
Yeah.
It lasts after death. Yeah. It lasts through Alzheimer's. It lasts in the moment of the one you adore. If you are willing to see them for the beauty and wonder that they always are, always have been, and always will be. So that's why I didn't give up. Yeah. On long-term love, even though Sean Cassidy broke my heart, even after a divorce of my first husband, even after multiple interesting, beautiful, committed relationships that ended, mm-hmm. even then, I still ended up on a blind date for breakfast 7 years ago. and ended up married to the fellow I thought I could get rid of after half an hour.
Just, you don't know where your path will take you. I think that's a really amazing story. And I think it's wonderful to have the stories of those people that have managed to keep it alive, that because I think they are the inspiration that tell us. And one thing I can say for myself is I've found that the very act of expressing admiration for my partner and verbalizing it, it's an act of loving him, not just a state of loving him, that actually enhances it as well. And so we can keep that admiration alive, and if we keep it, if we verbalize it, if we communicate it, if we share it. And yeah, it sounds like that's something that your grandfather did, and he kept that alive and with his wife. I want to thank you for this. And what I'd really like is to leave this off with some way that people can access, if you could give some information as to how can they access, especially for Valentine's Day coming up. Somebody might be interested in taking a peek at your site. Can you give us the information for that?
Certainly. The easiest way is the website, which is simply my name, drcherylfraser.com. And people can take the free passion quiz there and rate their own passion triangle. How strong or weak are they? Where should they be maybe putting their attention and love to renovate their relationship? They can also get on the waiting list for the next time I run the couples program. But really, the thing I think people would appreciate the most is every week I send out free little videos. If you wish, I call them love bites, and that's something you can sign up for at the website and get these free science-based tips and tools every week, little videos, sometimes they're written, giving you a challenge for this week or addressing a common problem or et cetera. And love for people to send me their questions. I'll answer them I do Facebook Lives and whatever I can do to help create exceptional couples, to help us, as I've said, fall in love over and over again with the one we're already with.
That's amazing. And thank you, Cheryl. This has been amazing. And perhaps maybe someday we'll have you on again if you were interested and do a little bit more talk about love and relationships. Thank you for taking the time to be here, because I know you're a busy woman. And so I feel very privileged that you gave me this hour. And hopefully this is going to be of value for listeners here who are looking to have a little bit more of a spark in their relationship, and perhaps to have a really enjoyable Valentine's Day, and think of some ideas of how to make it a special day for both of you. So thank you so much. And thank you again, Dr. Cheryl Fraser. And until next time, I wish you all the best and wish you a wonderful Valentine's Day with your partner. Take good care. Okay, let me just shut things down a bit here so we're not going to keep recording. I have two different sources.